This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Richard Palmer, staff writer for the Trumpet Magazine and instructor in international relations at Herbert W. Armstrong College. The city of Jerusalem is one of the most fought-over pieces of real estate in the history of the world. It is a sacred site for Christians, Jews, and Muslims. In our first segment, we'll talk about some developments in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran that could see that city fought over once again. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadaway will talk us through the crucial relationship between Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jerusalem, and Mecca. After a radical Muslim carried out a terrorist attack on a nightclub for homosexuals in Orlando, many on the left in America were quick to point the blame at the Christian right. Why was that? Trumpet writer Andrew Miller is going to talk us through an unusual alliance developing between the radical left and political Islam. In theory, the two groups should hate each other, but they do not. Andrew is going to tell us why. The rise of China is one of the biggest, easily predictable long-term trends. Analysts all around the world are talking and arguing about how it will change the world. Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood is going to talk to us about how China is buying up all kinds of companies, many of which are household names, all across Europe. He explains how this growing economic relationship actually represents a mortal danger for the United States. And we'll conclude by talking about Dover Castle and the important lesson of the tiny beds. All this and more on today's Trumpet Hour. God tells us to watch Jerusalem. You can tell a lot about world conditions by watching that city like no other city on earth. That is what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has written about the city of Jerusalem. It is a city that the Trumpet pays attention to like no other city on earth. It's the focal point for three of the world's religions. Geographically, it's at the crossroads between Europe and Asia and Africa. And it is right at the center of Bible prophecy. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadaway is working on an article about a significant development in this city. He joins me in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. Anthony, thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Now, I was really excited to hear about your article when you first mentioned the idea. Being in the news, I read a lot, but yours, I thought, made an original point that I'd not seen anywhere else that's very relevant to Jerusalem, and specifically in the way Iran views Jerusalem. But before we get there, perhaps you can give us just some of the background on how Islam views Jerusalem, because that really is fundamental to understanding this story.
Certainly, Richard. A lot of people in the world understand that the city of Jerusalem is very special to the Jews and to Christians. It seems like almost everyone understands that point, and it's very clear. But what maybe fewer people understand is that Jerusalem is also important to Muslims. In fact, Muslims consider Jerusalem to be the third holiest site in Islam. So Jerusalem is a holy city, according to Muslims and Jews and Christians. That's probably one thing that everyone agrees on. They agree that Jerusalem is a holy city. Now, the difference now comes when you start talking about who should control Jerusalem. That's where the main difference comes, because Jews want to control Jerusalem, of course, and some Christians probably still want the Jews to control Jerusalem. Some want to control Jerusalem themselves. And of course, Muslims want to control Jerusalem.
So what is it? Why? I mean, obviously, I think a lot of people know why Christianity views Jerusalem as holy. Obviously, Christ was there. Christ was crucified there. So much of the Old Testament is set there. It was the capital of the ancient city or the ancient kingdom of Judah. So we can understand quite easily why it's sacred to the Jews. But what's the connection to Islam? Why does Islam value this city so highly?
I think this is very fascinating. I was intrigued by it when I was doing research about it. I'm not a Muslim, so I'm not entirely familiar with what Muslims believe, what they think of Jerusalem. But when I reviewed this, I thought it was fascinating to learn that originally Muhammad, the founder of Islam, initially commanded Muslims to pray toward Jerusalem. I thought that was fascinating. Not to any other Muslim cities that most people are familiar with. It was Jerusalem that Muhammad was pointing Muslims to. So that's probably the first point that I can bring out about the importance of Jerusalem to Muslims. This was the place to which Muslims were supposed to pray to now. Now that has since changed. The Muhammad changed it himself, and we could talk about that later. He changed it to a different city, but originally it was Jerusalem. Muslims also believe that it was from Jerusalem, specifically the location of where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is today. That location, Muslims believe that that's where Muhammad took off when he went to heaven to receive more instructions from Allah and coming back to bring to Muslims. The Muslims believe that Muhammad took off from that area of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's the reason, that's one of the main reasons why Jerusalem is a holy site to Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen where he's supposed to have tied his horse up at some point while making that night journey. And then, of course, Islam and the Quran claim so many of the characters, if I can use that term, of the Bible as religious figures for their religion. They claim people like Jesus Christ as a prophet and King David. And so all of those events that happen, it makes all of those events that happen in Jerusalem relevant to their belief system as well. Well, the most important holy site, though, for Jerusalem, as I think everybody knows, is Mecca, and the second being Medina, both of which are in Saudi Arabia. Now, your article is bails a lot then around this rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia and how that relates to then these sacred sites of Islam. So perhaps you can go into some of this background. I think we're all fairly familiar, but the background between this this rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia and how that relates to those sacred sites.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Richard. I'm happy that you mentioned you mentioned the connection with Jerusalem and how Islam has similar beliefs, at least in terms of geography, at least in terms of some of the characters in the Bible. They believe in Abraham. They believe that there was an Abraham, and they believe that Jerusalem is a holy city, like we just discussed. But what's interesting about that, some of their beliefs, especially regarding Abraham, and this ties into the other holy cities in Islam. Muslims believe that Abraham was the one who first constructed the sanctuary that you find in Mecca today. Mecca is the holiest site for Muslims. And there's this mosque in Mecca, and it's at the center of that mosque. There's this square building that Muslims worship. I think it's about 43 feet tall, and they believe that Abraham was the one who first constructed that building. Now, of course, that was millennia ago, and they believe that it has been renovated from time to time, but on one corner of that building, there is what is called the Black Stone. Now, this Black Stone, they believe that it was supernaturally given to Abraham, and they believe that of the structure that we see today in Mecca right now, the Black Stone goes back to Abraham's time. Everything else has been renovated. The location is still the same, but the Black Stone is from the time of Abraham. That's what they believe in. They believe it's such a holy site. The pilgrimage to Mecca is one of the five fundamental pillars of Islam. So essentially, what defines a Muslim involves this pilgrimage to Mecca. So it is a very, very, very important, it's hard to overemphasize that. It is a very, very important city to Islam. Every Muslim who is capable, who is financially capable, physically capable to make the pilgrimage to Mecca is supposed to do so at least once in a lifetime. That's established a lot of importance. You don't even find that with Jerusalem among Christians and Jews necessarily, but among Muslims, it's so important. It's almost a life and death situation with this pilgrimage.
And which gives Saudi Arabia then a lot of power as the power that controls that site and can control who goes to it.
Tremendous power. And it's what's interesting about that power is that it's not only religious power, it's also political power, which is pretty significant. And they can pick and choose whether they want to exert religious power or they want to exert political power, but they have that at their disposal because you have all these Muslims who are duty bound to visit Saudi Arabia at least once in a lifetime. In fact, just to show how important this is to Muslims, even if you cannot go to Mecca, you can have someone make the pilgrimage for you on your behalf. Someone can go to Mecca on your behalf, and that kind of satisfies that requirement. That is, if you absolutely cannot go there. That's how super important the city is for Muslims.
So how does that then relate to, and this power that it gives Saudi Arabia, relate to the Iranian-Saudi rivalry that we see right now?
Before I get into that, there is another city, the second holiest site in Islam. It's Medina, and it's also found in Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia controls the two holiest site in Islam. So that gives them even more power. So it's not just Mecca, it's also Medina, and Saudi Arabia controls it all. Now, right now, Saudi Arabia and Iran, they've been fighting, they've been in a Cold War, essentially, fighting proxy wars with Iranians for years. You see that in Yemen today, you see that in Syria, you see that in many parts of the Middle East. And I think one important point to bring out from this, the fact that they are fighting each other, at least from Saudi Arabia's point of view, is that Saudi Arabia realizes the threat that Iran poses. I'm not saying I agree with everything that Saudi Arabia does to try to fix that problem, but it recognizes the problem better than the United States does, apparently, because we're getting into these deals with a nuclear deal with Iran. Saudi Arabia recognizes the danger that Iran poses, and it's willing to do whatever it takes, even if it means cutting off Iranians from worshiping in Mecca. They are willing to do that because they understand how high the stakes are.
So is that where Saudi Arabia is going now, towards cutting off Iranian citizens from Mecca?
Certainly. That's certainly what's happening. It's not necessarily the first time it has happened, but it's the first time in 30 years this has happened. Almost 30 years ago, there was an incident at Mecca during the pilgrimage. And there was an accident. People died. Iran was upset by that. And the two sides cut off contact, and Iranian Muslims couldn't attend the pilgrimage in Mecca for that. But they resolved that, and for 30 years, everything has been fine with regards to this pilgrimage until this year.
And what happened this year?
What happened this year actually is tied to what happened last year. Last year, some of our listeners might recall this, might remember this. Last year, there was, I think, a crane that crashed, and there was a stampede that followed, and the whole chaos killed about 2,000 Muslims during this pilgrimage to this holy city. 2,000 Muslims were killed during this incident. And about 460 of those Muslims were Iranians. And Iranians were very upset about that. And remember, these two countries have been going at it for a long time. And now you have 460 Iranians being killed. And essentially, Iran has been blaming Saudi Arabia for incompetence and demanding that they shouldn't control these holy cities. So they have been negotiating about that. Iran has been making demands about what should happen at the next pilgrimage, this year's pilgrimage, and going on. They had been in discussions about that earlier this year. And it also coincided with that time when Iran and Saudi Arabia cut off diplomatic contact with each other. So it was a very tense development, a tense situation for the two countries. They did try to negotiate a solution to this year's pilgrimage, but that all collapsed. Saudi Arabia thought that Iran's demands were unreasonable. They thought that Iran wanted to create chaos in Saudi Arabia. They were demanding that Iranian Muslims be allowed to demonstrate during the pilgrimage, and they were demanding some of the benefits that would be only advantageous to Iranian Shiites. So naturally, Saudi Arabia wouldn't accept that. So in the end, it came to a point where Iran decided that Iranian Muslims are not going to Mecca for this pilgrimage.
So it's not that Saudi Arabia has actually banned Iranian citizens. It's that Iran has said, we are not going to let our citizens leave the country for Saudi Arabia for this pilgrimage. Is that what's happened?
That's how it comes across as. But from an Iranian point of view, this Saudi Arabians during these negotiations placed obstacles that made it impossible for Iranians to attend the pilgrimage. So Iranians will say that it is Saudi Arabia who essentially banned Muslims by not trying to renegotiate how the pilgrimage is supposed to work. There were problems last year, and Iran has been trying to negotiate with the Saudi Arabians to make sure that things like that don't happen, among other things, I'm sure. But Iran has been blaming Saudi Arabia for placing obstacles in those negotiations, which eventually collapsed. So I think you can look at it both ways, really. Iran decided its Muslims are not going to Mecca. In a sense, you could also say that Saudi Arabia prevented Iranian Muslims from going to Mecca because of some of the obstacles they placed during those negotiations.
So let's bring this back round to Jerusalem now, because this is where I think was the main thrust of your article here. So what now then is Iran doing, and how does that involve Jerusalem?
It goes back to what we started off discussing at the beginning. Islam has three main holy sites. The holiest of all the cities in Islam, the first one is Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia. The second one is Medina, which also is in Saudi Arabia. And the third one is Jerusalem. Iran has absolutely no control over any of those cities. But we know that Iran wants to control all three of those cities. There were some reports. There's a report that I found from a terrorist expert who was quoting an Iranian general who said that we are not going to war against any Muslim country, but Saudi Arabia is an exception. So already you're seeing hints of Iran trying to attack Saudi Arabia in a more direct way. They've been fighting each other via proxies, but now you're getting hints of Iran trying to attack Saudi Arabia. I don't know if that will ever happen. It seems highly unlikely that Iran will actually attack Saudi Arabia, considering the military might that Saudi Arabia has. I don't think it's as strong as Iran's, but they do have something. And they, you know, Saudi Arabia has been building this coalition of about 34 Sunni nations. So I'd think that Iran doesn't have a chance when it comes to Mecca or Medina. But when it comes to Jerusalem, it's a little bit of a different story because of what we already know about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a very divided city. There are a lot of Palestinians in Jerusalem, especially East Jerusalem, and terrorists for that matter. In East Jerusalem, Iran has been funding those terrorists for years. They've been, its leaders have been talking about wiping Israel off the map, describing Israel as a cancer that has to be removed. And they've promised that it will be removed. In fact, last year, in November last year, the Iranian military, they had these military drills where they created this replica of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they were acting out as if they were taking over that mosque, taking it from the control of Israel. So they want to take over. They want to take over Jerusalem. Iranian pilgrims couldn't go to Mecca this year. They found a substitute, and it was a holy city. I think it's Karbala in Iraq. So Karbala was their substitute. It's not one of the top three. It's not one of the top three holy cities in Islam. But for now, Karbala, Iraq, was their substitute. Would they rather go for Jerusalem? That's the big question, and Bible prophecy indicates that he has a keen eye on Jerusalem.
Right, so to sum some of this up, you know, Jerusalem is the third most holy city. Muslims, they have to make a pilgrimage in their lifetime. Iran is cut off from the top two cities, so it would be very logical that they would go for number three. We also see that they've got a lot of strong links over there in Jerusalem, and this is... And this is about a lot more than just religious preference. You know, Iran is trying to derive so much of its power from leading a lot of terrorist groups and by really portraying itself as the head of the Islamic world, the king of Islam. And so by gaining access to Jerusalem, it would greatly increase its stature. At the moment, it's cut off from all of the top three cities. So this is something that would really advance Iran's power. But you continue, you just finished up your section there by talking about Bible prophecy. And as we mentioned at the start, you know, this is something we have a very keen eye on prophetically. So can you tell us now just about what the Bible says about Iran and about Jerusalem?
Iran, the Bible describes Iran as the king of the south, leading this king of the south, which is radical Islam. It leads radical Islam. It has been for years. And it has been involving itself in a lot of the affairs of the Middle East. And I think maybe the most prominent example of this is with Iraq. When Saddam Hussein was in power, Iran didn't have that much of an influence in Iraq. But now that Saddam has been removed, Iran has been doing everything it could to get into Iraq. And now because Iran did that, because Iran meddled in the affairs of Iraq, now it has a holy site to its disposal. Now it has a holy site where Iranian pilgrims can go to instead of Mecca. And as you indicated, Jerusalem would be the preferred site for them other than the two Saudi Arabian cities. And the Bible in Zechariah 14, it does talk about a split in Jerusalem that's coming very soon. It talks about half of the city falling. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Jared Fleury, in his booklet Jerusalem and Prophecy, he explains his prophecies in detail, and we know that half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, is predominantly Palestinian, and Iran has been heavily involved with that, and it wants a takeover of all of Jerusalem, but it Bible prophecy indicates that they will only gain control of East Jerusalem. That's the prophecy that you can read in Zechariah 14 verses 1 through 2, and that's a very profound prophecy, because that essentially triggers events that lead up to the return of Jesus Christ, and he will be returning to Jerusalem. So very, very, very inspiring prophecies. And when you see these developments, even this rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's amazing to see how it's pointing toward Jerusalem, the division of Jerusalem that's prophesied in the Bible, and Jesus Christ's soon coming return.
That really is amazing. Thank you for bringing that to us, Anthony.
You're welcome.
That book that Anthony mentioned at the end there, Jerusalem in Prophecy, is available for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can go there, you can read it online, you can request your own personal print copy that we will deliver to you again for free.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Andrew Miller is working on an article talking about an unusual alliance that's having a big impact on the American political scene and really on political politics around the world: the radical left and political Islam. If you look at what these two think, you'd think they would be implacable enemies, but they're not. Andrew, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, good to be in the studio.
Perhaps you could start by outlining what this alliance looks like.
Right. Well, I think anyone who's spent much time to listening to mainstream media reports in America or Britain has probably puzzled a little bit over just the amount of effort these outlets will use to just bend over backwards defending even sometimes like an Islamist ideology against conservative Christians. And it's definitely not something that just those on the conservative side of this political spectrum have noticed. You'll even have very famous atheists or leftists like Bill Maher or Richard Dawkins, who are really pointing out that their leftist ideology, they're supposedly against sexism, against racism, against homophobia, and against Islamophobia. And yet they'll defend any act of violence against homosexuals or any act of terrorism done by someone who's Islamic as an aberration or something that has nothing to do with their ideology. Yet if a Christian were to do something like that, in the rare cases that happens, they will bend over backwards trying to portray that almost as like a core tenet of Christianity. And for this article I'm working on, I was reading like an article in Alternate, it's a left-wing news source that's really talking about how they say the future of life on the planet is being jeopardized by white supremacist ideology of American Christian Republicans like Senator Ted Cruz or Dr. Ben Carson, which first of all kind of seems a little strange in that Dr. Ben Carson's black and Senator Ted Cruz is at least half Hispanic. And second of all, I just really completely ignore the fact that actually many of the nations that have just overt skin color-based slavery today are Islamic. Let's have the Islamic Republic in North Africa, especially Mauritania, has they estimate up to about 800,000 Africans enslaved based to Arab masters based mainly on their skin color due to the fact that they're black. And yet it gets almost no media attention as sources just focus in on black Republicans who are apparently white supremacists.
And I guess this is also exactly what we saw after the Orlando shooting as well, with that being a radical Islamic shooter that was somehow the fault of the Christian right.
Right. He's the son of an Afghani immigrant who was a Muslim who pledged his allegiance to ISIS. And despite the fact that about one out of five Muslim majority countries punishes homosexuality with death these days, the New York Times really bent over backwards trying to prove that, well, his decision to shoot 49 homosexuals in a nightclub in Florida had nothing to do with the fact that he pledged allegiance to ISIS or that he was a proponent of radical Islamic ideology. They said it was this radical racist culture being espoused by Republican politicians that was rubbing off on him that caused him to do that.
So what on earth is motivating the rhetorical gymnastics behind this? Why put all of this effort to somehow ally with Islam and denigrate anyone with the traditional Christian views?
It is an interesting question, and then probably most mainstream people you'd ask that will say, well, it's like a religious freedom type thing. You'll see a lot of I read something in the Chicago Monitor just recently by this saying that Muslims and atheists and leftists are oppressed minorities that need to gang up together against the Christian majority to protect their rights. And that's definitely an interesting opinion, especially considering that, to my knowledge, there's never been an example of an atheist or a secularist or an Islamist state that's offered religious freedoms. That's something that's been relatively unique to countries, mostly Christian culture countries, that believe that people are endowed with their creator with an inalienable right to practice their whatever religion they choose. But this article from the Chicago Monitor, it really does strike close to the heart of the idea of why a leftist would be able to compromise some of their beliefs regarding sexism or some of their beliefs on homosexuals or on racism to kind of brush some of these atrocities being conducted by radical Islamists under the rug in order to form like a broad-based countercultural alliance against what they perceive as the dominant culture in the Western world.
Now, in your article, you talked about some examples from history where there have been similar alliances and what the outcome of those alliances for similar goals to overthrow an existing status quo have been. Perhaps you could talk us through what the historic precedent kind of tells us about where this is leading.
Right. Well, almost any time a movement wants to change a government, they will form alliances with other movements who want to change that government, especially in revolutions. You get like Bolshevik Revolution, Iranian Revolution, even in like Tiananmen Square in Cairo, where you'll get people of a whole variety of different beliefs that hate the current government will form an alliance to either transform or topple that government and set up a new one. And now that's usually where things get messy, is where after that government is toppled and then all this broad-based group fight over their new idea of what the new government should be like. But one of the most interesting cases was definitely the 1979 revolution in Iran, where you had the Shah of Iran, who was an authoritarian leader, pro-American authoritarian leader, who he had definitely Ayatollah Khomeini and his Islamists were fighting against him for a revolution. But you also had Iranian communist groups that were fighting with him and Iranian democratic socialist groups that were fighting with him and even other just regular secularists that were fighting against him. And they all kind of coalesced around the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini to topple the Shah's government. And of course, once it was toppled, the revolution entered its consolidation phase, which took place over the early 80s, and we're up to 30,000 communists and leftists and other secularists in Iran were imprisoned and killed because they'd been condemned as unbelievers. And I think that is really one of the most striking modern examples of two ideologies, the Iranian left and the Iranian Islamist groups, that have nothing in common, that teamed up to take down a government that they may have even rightfully viewed as oppressive, and then turned on each other after the fact. And so that it is definitely, and even though the Iranian revolution is definitely more of an extreme, a violent takeover of a government, it is even a cautionary tale to those that try to transform governments slowly from within, is that it can be very effective in the short term if you don't like your nation's culture, or if you don't like your nation's government, to form a very broad countercultural alliances of many ideologies. But if those ideologies don't value religious freedom or political freedom, like Islam, like radical Islam doesn't value those things, and even the radical left doesn't value those things, once the current government's been transformed, there's the danger that, okay, now you've got an alliance that has nothing in common that starts imploding and turning in on itself.
Right. So, that was actually going to be my next question, is just where is this leading? But I guess, is that it really? When it's successful, a coalition that starts fighting among themselves?
Right. Well, is it because that is one common thing that you'll especially see in America and Britain on the radical left. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the more centralist leftists, but definitely the radical left it's becoming more common to really just talk about how much they hate the U.S. Constitution, or hate Britain's oral constitution and their traditions, and that they figure these traditions and this constitution is restraining the power of government to do good things for the people, and so they want it abolished. Which, maybe somewhat ironically, is and for completely different reasons, a lot of the radical Islamists do the same thing. I think that the statistics are pretty consistent between America and Britain, that the polls they've done say roughly 20% of the Islamic community wants Sharia law to be implemented in their communities. And for that to happen, the Constitution or the British common law has to go out the window. And I'm not necessarily saying that they want a violent overthrow like they'd seen in Iran, but you still see a convergence of interest between these radical Islamists who want Sharia law and these radical leftists who want an enormous state government, is that the Constitution and the traditions of limited government have to go. And so in the short term, they've got the exact same goal. Now, once, if you could actually do away with the Constitution and abolish the culture that's dominated these two nations for the last 200 years, now you would have this Islamist view and this radical leftist view of what the nation should look like after. That's going to be very different. So obviously the alliance can't continue long term.
Great. Well, Andrew's written this up in an article titled, or at least with a working title, Political Islam Meet the Radical Left. And this ties into a trend that we're really watching very closely here at thetrumpet.com and with the Trumpet magazine. It's outlined in a book that we've got called America Under Attack, and another book called Great Again, that just charts how so many of the God-given blessings to America, including the stable government that America's enjoyed for the last 200 years and more, are now being taken away. And this is something that is a very important part of that trend. You can go on our website and read either of the, or, and order either a free copy of either of those two books if you'd like to learn more. Andrew, thank you for coming on the show and bringing that to us.
All right, thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
As you know, we deal with the big, important trends at the Trumpet Magazine, and one of the biggest, most important, predictable long-term trends is the rise of China. How will this new aspiring superpower change the world? Our trumpet writer Kieran Underwood has been looking at one aspect of this, China's growing relationship with Europe. Kieran, welcome. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much.
Can you start by outlining just how deep this economic relationship that you're talking about is?
Well, I think to understand how deep it is, you have to look a little bit back in the past. Initially, China has not had, historically, China has not had a lot of trade with the rest of the world. This is our recent history. Back in very ancient history, they did have a thriving trade route there. But before really the Nixon-Kissinger opening of China, they really didn't have a lot of trade with anyone outside of their region. But as that was opened, they really took off. As you know, it's become the second largest economy in the world. But instead of turning to America, they're really turning to Europe instead now. At the moment, America still beats the Europeans in trade with China just, but there's the trend is that that China is looking to Europe instead of looking to America.
And your article makes the point that this is no accident. This is a result of deliberate policy decisions by the Chinese.
Yeah, the big thing about Chinese enterprises is that they're controlled a lot by the government, as most people know. Then it's not entirely restrictive, but if something big gets done, it's because the Chinese government says, we're going to get this done, and they get the funds in there. So when they say, we're going to push into Europe, that's when the businessmen get all the funds to do so.
So why has the government made this decision to really pursue Europe instead of the United States?
Well, I think there's two reasons. The first one is they're on the same continent, the Eurasian continent. As George Friedman from Geopolitical Futures always says, it contains 2/3 of the world's population. It contains 5 billion people. So why not trade on the same continent? Europe's there. You don't have to go by so far, thousands and thousands of miles to get to the US. You can go straight to Europe. But the second reason I think is a little more important is that China and the US have been conflicting very, very heavily in the South China Sea and in different things. Recently, we see China insulting President Barack Obama. They're really clashing in a number of different things. So the Chinese government really doesn't want to increase its cooperation with the United States. And whether they look to, there's another great and massive power in Europe. And that's where they say, let's push into that instead of pushing into America.
So why does this matter? Why do we need to be concerned about this Chinese push?
Well, I think as George Friedman has also said, the only power or conglomerate of powers that could ever compete with the United States are those two powers in the Eurasian continent. So China, that Chinese and Russian cooperation, which we already see, and the Europe cooperation. Those two entities are the only ones which could really put a squeeze on America economically or militarily. But right now, that union is obviously just an economic union at the moment.
So can you give us a sense of what this economic union looks like right now? And what are some of these ties? Is it just a case of Chinese businesses trading with Europe? Or what exactly is going on there?
Well, there's a lot of foreign investment, and sometimes it's really easy to get bored by these statistics. I mean, I can tell you that there's 467 billion euros worth of goods, but that doesn't really mean a lot. One of the interesting things that I found when I was researching this is a few of the businesses that the Chinese investors have gone in with the help of these huge Chinese banks and bought out those companies. So in the English from the English. They bought Pizza Express, which is a famous company. From the Italians, they bought the tire manufacturing company, which is Pirelli. They do every single tire for Formula One. So they bought out that. They bought out Volvo from the Swedish. They bought shares in Weet-Bix from the English. And from all these other countries, they're buying up a lot of things. So from 2010 to 2014, the investment, Chinese investment into Europe went from $6 billion to $55 billion. So that has to do with real estate. Of course, the Chinese are famous for buying up real estate. They do it in Australia. They do it in New Zealand. And they do it in Europe as well. It's gone from $6 billion to $55 billion, which is a huge increase.
And I eat Weetabix every morning for breakfast. So, yeah, I can attest that these are big, important brands. Now, in your article, you single out China's relationship with Germany as being especially significant. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, Germany, the exports from Europe, 45% of them come from Germany. So it's really huge. In terms of imports, the United Kingdom is actually larger. Well, foreign investment it's larger in the United Kingdom. Of course, they're leaving. But in exports, Germany just dominates the trade with China. And their chancellor, Angela Merkel, she loves visiting China every year, except for one, I think, in the 11 years of her chancellorship. She has gone to China. She loves having discussions with them because they're both these powerful manufacturing countries. They're very similar in that way. And most analysts realize that there really is a very strong connection between the Chinese and the Germans.
Now, a big part of the reason that we're watching this trend of this growing closeness between Europe and China is because of some important prophecies in the Bible. Could you outline some of that prophetic basis for watching what we're talking about today?
Yeah, well, I think it was around 7 years ago when Mr. Gerald Flurry pointed to one of the verses in Isaiah 23, or Isaiah for some other pronunciations. And it warns of an end-time mart of nations. And this mart of nations is not really a permanent thing. It's a short-term prophecy where these two nations or this group of nations sets up an economic alliance to put the squeeze on the U.S. And, of course, when the goal is done, when that economic squeeze is finished, those nations, they cut off that alliance. But in the lead up to that, you can see that might of nations forming. Mr. Ron Fraser wrote about it about 4 years ago when he highlighted how much that relationship between Germany and China was developing.
Great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Kieran. You can look, Kieran's article is called The Chinese Economic Offensive in Europe. You can look for that on the Trumpet website shortly. You can also look for more of that information on those prophecies in the booklet called Isaiah's End Time Vision. And we also have an article on this subject in the October edition of the Trumpet magazine, a magazine that you can order for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. Kieran, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for asking me in.
It's time for today's last word.
A few years ago, I visited Dover Castle. This is one of my favorite castles, as you get a huge variety of history there. The castle goes back about 1,000 years. It's often been used as a base when it comes to war between England and Europe. It has exhibits on things like the Plantagenet dynasty and the Hundred Years' War. There are sites there used in planning England's defence in things like the Napoleonic Wars, and there's exhibits on World War II and Winston Churchill. The castle was used, for example, to plan the famous Dunkirk evacuations, and there's a great exhibit all about that, and you can go through a lot of the tunnels that were used during World War II. But on this visit, there was one tiny detail that stood out to me the most. Now, there are lots of more substantive things I took from that visit, but one of the biggest things that stayed with me was the tiny beds. The middle of the castle is what is called the keep. It's a place that was meant to be the most secure part of the castle, and it's where the people who lived in the lord of the castle and his family would live and would sleep. And at the keep in this castle, at Dover Castle, they tried to make it look as authentic as possible. Usually, when you go around castles, they look kind of dark and drab and grey and brown. Here, there was a lot of vibrant colour. They tried to make it look the way that the castle would have looked before the paint and before the fabric faded. And inside this keep and inside its brightly coloured interiors were, in the sleeping quarters, these tiny, brightly coloured beds. They looked just like children's beds, that same kind of size and the same kind of colour. But they were, in fact, for adults. Now, why was this the case? People weren't midgets back then. They may well have been slightly shorter on average than people who are today, maybe 2 or 3 inches, but not midgets. Well, these tiny beds were there because, in the Middle Ages, people slept sitting up. And this tiny revelation from this visit really stayed with me. Sleeping, probably the single activity we do more than any other, unless you count breathing, was completely different in the past. You know, we take it for granted. You lie down and go to sleep. Well, that wasn't true in Middle Age Europe. Then you sat down on your bed, propped up by pillows, and went to sleep. Our assumption of what is natural and normal in the world today can be radically skewed by our brief experience of life. You know, we think it is normal to sleep lying down. We think that's the only way to sleep, and we would never think of sleeping in any different posture. But if we take the long view, we may realize that what we think is normal may be different or unusual to the rule. We tend to view the world through the lens of the present, and that affects our understanding of everything. It affects our understanding of even world events and the news. And this little detail from this visit to Dover Castle made me think, you know, how many things do we just accept as normal, as the way things are, that in the long view of history are actually unusual, or at least just one of several ways that things can be? And that can apply to something as small as being as the way we sleep, but also to much bigger things. Democracy. Today, we just take it for granted that that is the default form of government. Peace and prosperity, at least for those of us in the Western world, well, that's just what's normal. We accept these as the way things are, but is that really the case? What is normal? What is constant? What changes? Is this the way that our world has been for most of history, or are we unusual? To really understand that, we need historical context. This isn't the only thing that we need history for. History repeats itself, and we can learn so much about what will happen in the future from what has happened in the past. We also need history to explain the world that we live in, to tell us why things are the way that they are. Towards the beginning of his book, Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, "We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing." And the lesson of the tiny beds relates to these other lessons that we can learn from history. To really understand our brief existence, to understand things like human nature, the laws that govern how nations function, interact, the true patterns of history. To understand those, we need far more than the brief experience that our short human lives afford us. We need history. And that was the lesson of the tiny beds. Even a question as simple as, how do I go to sleep, has been answered very differently in the past. History gives us access to a much greater overview of human experience, and so allows us to put our lives to put world events, to put what we're seeing around us in proper context, and then use that context to understand the true state of the world. You've been listening to Trumpet Hour. I'm Richard Palmer, standing in for your regular host, Trumpet Managing Editor Joel Hilliker. My guests today were Anthony Tabardaway, Andrew Miller, and Kieran Underwood. Tune in again on Friday for our regular Week in Review session, and until then, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.